Okay, what they accomplished was to chart, to start off with, let me drop. Every reasonable diameter of wire, every reasonable length of wire for the so-called monopole antenna, by way of the slotted line, the frequency meter, and the signal generator, they measured the exact impedance. And impedance consists of two separate components. There's a resistive component and a reactive component. And they quantified the resistive component and the reactive component and made a whole bunch of graphs, which eventually got compacted down to two individual graphs. And if you go to those two websites of Mike number one and Mike number two, you will be able to find the article by K2LIW of perfectly impedance matching a dipole. And you will see these two graphs. The resistive graph is a whole bunch of lines for when you sweep in frequency and you've got various diameters of wire. They call that the A to D ratio, call it the diameter to length ratio of your wire. That'll choose a particular curve. Your particular wire might have a 100-to-1 ratio of diameter to length. And you look at the curve that's labeled 100, and now as you sweep it in frequency, and they didn't do it in frequency in megahertz, they did it in phase angle. Once you know the length of your wire, you know what the quarter wave resonance is going to be, and if you set it exactly a quarter wavelength of wire, you know it's going to be a quarter wavelength long. One wavelength is 360 degrees, quarter wavelength is 90 degrees. Let me drop. So if you look at that curve, the horizontal axis, it's labeled between 0 and 360 degrees. And if you look at the 90 degree point on the horizontal axis, that is the point of resonance. Quarter wavelength long for a so-called quarter wave monopole antenna, we call that resonant. And you look at the impedance, and you'll notice that almost all of those wires of almost any diameter are very close to 37 ohms for a monopole, which turns out to be 73 ohms for a dipole. That's the resistive component. Then you look at the second set of curves, the second graph, and you see a whole bunch of A to D's again, where now, by the exact same horizontal axis, it's plotting the vertical axis, the reactive component. But when you look at that reactive component, you'll see something very exciting. That is to say, for reasonable diameters, like 1,000-to-1, and by the way, if you and I built a 80-meter dipole out of 14-gauge wire, your A to D ratio in that case is close to 10,000-to-1. He's got a whole bunch of curves there that go all the way up to 1,000, and you can see the trend. The curves become more and more steep as you go to a higher and higher A to D ratio. So you can now picture what would happen for your 80-meter dipole on a 14-gauge wire. You'd have a very steep curve. The bottom line of this, let me drop, is that as I sweep away from frequency, I've now got this dipole at resonant frequency, where it's exactly 90 degrees long electronically. The reactive component is 0 ohms. The resistive component is 37 ohms for a monopole, which turns out to be 73 ohms for a dipole. And I start going down in frequency. The curve of reactance, which is the equivalent circuit of your dipole, is a series resistor, which we call the radiation resistance, and a series black box that we call the reactance, which if the dipole is too long, that the reactance is inductive. If the dipole is too short, the reactance is capacitive. As I'm going down in frequency, and I'm not changing the length of my dipole, it becomes a capacitive reactance. But the capacitive reactance happens real fast. You'll notice from that curve that all I have to do is go down a few percent in frequency, where the dipole, the monopole, is no longer resonant, and all of a sudden, the 73 ohms, the 37 ohms of resistance, suddenly has in series with it a few thousand ohms of capacitive reactance. And as you start going down in frequency, the capacitive reactance happens very fast. The slope of capacitance change versus resistive change is probably 100-to-1 steeper. In other words, almost any reasonable antenna that you and I are likely to build, let me drop. If you feed it at the wrong frequency, your instrumentation will tell you it's got high standard wave ratio. You can measure that with a slotted line, with a Berg watt meter, with an antenna analyzer. There's all kinds of instruments where you could measure the standing wave ratio. You go a little bit lower in frequency than the resonant frequency of your antenna, and you'll recognize that almost all the antennas we use, the standing wave ratio builds up real fast. What does that mean? The standing wave ratio means that your 50-ohm coax cable did not see what it thinks is a 50-ohm resistor at the far end. it's seeing some number of ohms of resistance of your dipole in series with a few thousand ohms of capacitor reactance. A few thousand ohms of capacitor reactance is very close to an open circuit. Your ammeter will show almost no current. As you go down to lower and lower frequencies and you start approaching DC, your capacitor reactance probably becomes megohms and gigohms of capacitor reactance. So that piece of wire you started off with at DC, DC is the lowest frequency you can possibly get, and you're going to see a capacitor reactance that is only a few picofarads, so to speak, if you measure the capacitance directly with a capacitance measuring meter. But that's another way of looking at it, as an antenna that's way, way too short. It now has megohms of capacitor reactance. That's damn close to an open circuit. Your ammeter, unless your ammeter can measure femto ohms, you know, 10 to the minus 15 ohms, unless it can measure something extremely small, femto amperes, unless it was the most sensitive thing in the world, you're not going to see anything anything happening. Now, that piece of wire, there's two pieces of wire coming out of your dry cell battery, your 1.5-volt battery. That I could consider as a piece of twin lead transmission line. Let me give you a transmission line equivalent of all of the above. Let's assume now that I've got two pieces of wire close enough together that they act like a 73-ohm impedance twin lead. I could do that. Maybe I've got to wrap the two wires together and leave their insulation on. But I can easily make 73-ohm twin lead transmission line. And in my example, I'm going to recognize the fact that if the dielectric of this transmission line was primarily air, it's not quite true, but I'm going to round off the numbers. If it was air, I know that electrical energy travels at the speed of light. Speed of light quite often is quoted as 186,000 miles per second. So in my mental example, I'm going to take half that distance. 186,000 divided by 2 is, I think, 93,000. If my twin lead happened to be made out of lossless wire, this is an ideal head experiment, if you know what I mean. Lossless wire, lossless dielectric material, and it's 93,000 miles long. It's a fraction of a way between here and the moon, if you know what I mean. So I now apply my ohmmeter, my ammeter, with this battery, and let me increase the battery voltage so the numbers come out reasonable. I've made 73-ohm twin lead, and my battery just happens to be a power supply of 73 volts. 73 volts across 73 ohms, by Ohm's law, would be a current of 1 ampere. So at the instant I connect my battery through the ammeter to this twin lead that's 93,000 miles long, I will see a current of exactly 1 ampere flowing. My 73-ohm impedance of my twin lead is called the surge impedance. It's called the characteristic impedance. It's given a lot of names. In other words, under normal conditions, when it's being used in the correct way, let me drop it. If I had a very long length of 73-ohm transmission line in a black box, and the second black box is a 73-ohm resistor, and you make measurements on the outside of each of those black boxes, you would not be able to tell the difference with one exception, the time domain. Because I made the transmission line 93,000 miles long, half the speed of light for 1 second, half the distance for the speed of light, what happens is that my 73 volts, I get applied to the wire looks like it's a 73-ohm resistor, 1 ampere flows. The 73 volts is now a rising waveform traveling down that wire. In half a second, it gets to the end of the wire, 93,000 miles away. The open circuit means that that last couple of inches of wire, all of a sudden, the current that was at 1 ampere goes to zero. Now you have a zero pulse of current propagating back from the open circuit. I chose 93,000 miles because that is half the distance of the speed of light, but now my signal goes down there, hits the open circuit, and comes back. It took half a second to get to the open circuit, my 73-volt pulse. The open circuit comes back in another half second. So in other words, I'm now watching my ammeter. When I make connection to this twin lead, 93,000 miles long, I will see exactly 1 ampere flowing for exactly 1 second, and all of a sudden, the current will go to zero. Because now 1 second later, my 73-volt power supply has sensed the fact that it is now seeing the end of that cable, which is an open circuit. Had I put a 73-ohm resistor out there, the 1 ampere current would flow forever. If I put a short circuit out there, other things will happen. The current will double, and now a pulse of twice the current spreads back, and all of a sudden my ammeter jumps to 2 amperes. If I...
Repeater, timeout.
If I had a short circuit at the far end, I would see exactly 1 ampere flowing for exactly 1 second, and all of a sudden the 1 ampere would jump to either 2 or 3 amperes. I think it's 2 amperes it would jump to. And then the next cycle of the higher current going down the cable, and when that reflects back, it'll jump up to 3 amperes. Whether it jumps by 1 or jumps by 2, I have to go through the mathematics of that. But it'll slowly jump up in steps once every second. You're now seeing some of the characteristics of a transmission line. So what we've done here with these two wires coming out of Roger's battery is we've gone the next step and made it into a transmission line. We either did or didn't make the transmission line a quarter wavelength long at the right frequency. We now have sort of a continuous flow of energy, but sometimes it makes the ammeter move because you've hit resonance, or the ammeter doesn't move because you're so far away from resonance that the capacitive reactance of that so-called antenna is almost infinity and no current flows. Or we can extend the wires as a twisted pair, 93,000 miles long, and we'll see these beautiful transmission line characteristics. So are we discussing a transmission line? Are we discussing an antenna? The answer is yes and yes. Depends on your point of view. The twin lead is a kind of transmission line that intentionally doesn't radiate, although there's ways you can make it radiate. As you can tell, your simple sounding... Let me drop this. Your simple sounding question now, Roger, has the capability of illustrating a hell of a lot of individual phenomena of radio signals being used, of electronic signals going down a piece of wire, and whether or not it does radiate, whether or not it does draw current, how much current it draws, what direction is the current, what's the time domain of the current. There's a lot of things to be learned from this simple sounding experiment. Look what you started, Roger. K2 Juliet Alpha Sierra in Florida. K2IW and TechNet. Over to you, Roger.
Okay, K2JAS Portable 4. Nick, hold on a second. I wonder if you can hear the applause. You've made my night. I didn't ask the question because it was a rhetorical question, or I was fishing for anything. I just wanted to know, and I wasn't able to until you've cleared the water. So thank you so much for your explanation. That was a beauty. Now it's going to take some gestation time to digest it all. But bravo, bravo. Thank you. Back to you, okay, Jim.
Comment, Dick.
Hey, John, we've got a happy customer. That's one of the happiest customers we've had for a while. Do we push our luck and send him a bill? Not at all. KC2WGB, K2IW. Go ahead, John.
Great question, KC2WGB. Dick, I just want, maybe you'd want to point out the fact that although he has an ammeter in that primary, the antenna, it's radiating a specific amount of amperes. That does not mean amperes in that receive wire are going to be the same because of other nearby resonant objects. You might want to explain that to him, because that could be the next question coming up.
Yeah, whenever you try to make a measurement of an antenna, it's a very, very different measurement than when you make a measurement of, say, an amplifier or a resistor or a capacitor sitting on the bench. Let's assume there's an amplifier sitting on the bench, and I apply my signal generator to the input of the amplifier, I've applied my power supply to power up the amplifier, and I put my signal detector on the output of the amplifier. On the desk, I've got complete control of the environment. All the environment really is inside that box containing the amplifier, and I make some very nice measurements. You now go to your backyard, and you think you're going to measure an antenna. And you think the antenna is what you've measured. You've really made a measurement of the antenna and all of the environment around it. on almost all the frequencies we're likely to use, you're going to get some reflection off the ground. Depending on how many wavelengths is between your antenna and the ground, whether the antenna is aimed, if it's a Yagi antenna, whether it's aimed toward the ground, toward the horizon, or straight up, you'll get different answers. If there are other nearby objects, when I set up my antenna range in my backyard, if I'm not using pretty directive antennas, some of the side lobes of the antenna look at the reflection from the downspout tubing on my house, the house itself, the plumbing inside the house, to a radio signal. Your house doesn't look like a house. It's a great big set of monkey bars, which has got a whole bunch of plumbing, a whole bunch of wiring, a whole bunch of gutters, downspouts. It's got all kinds of metallic objects. It's a complicated thing. And now, there are formulas that'll tell you, let me drop quick. How close is the nearby object, and is the nearby object resonant at your frequency? To a radar expert, the nearby object has a certain reflection characteristic, which the radar expert calls it radar equivalent cross-section, rated in square meters. You could say it's acting like a flat plate of X number of square meters. It's not really a flat plate. The radar standard is a conducting sphere, which has a certain amount of projected area to it. So if the metallic object nearby acted like a metallic sphere that projects a 1 meter shadow at high noon, that by definition to a radar person is a circuit, is an object that has exactly 1 square meter of radar cross-section. And you can take a relatively small object, and all of a sudden you adjust the object so that it hits resonance. At the instant that object hits resonance, its radar cross-section, its effective capture area, its effective reflecting area, jumps to a much, much bigger number. So how close are the objects, whether or not they're resonant, will make some changes to the measurements you make from the antenna. There are some people who lose a lot of sleep over this. If I'm trying to measure the pattern of the antenna, the reflection off these extraneous objects are going to make my life pretty complicated. If I'm measuring only the impedance of the antenna, the good news is that most of the time, the nearby objects don't make a significant change of the impedance unless they get in the vicinity of 1 or 2 wavelengths away from the antenna on the test. If all the objects in your environment happen to be non-resonant and they're all more than 2 or 3 wavelengths away, the total amount of change of the impedance of the antenna that you measure will be pretty small in the presence of those objects. Let me drop. Also, if you now put on your radar engineering hat, and you know that you've got some reflective objects nearby to your antenna, and for a whole bunch of reasons you can't remove those objects, maybe one of them is a building, if you know what I mean, and you can't get rid of the building very easily, but you still want to make the measurement in this particular backyard, and there's this 10-story building alongside, because the reflection of the building has a certain exact distance from you, you can change the distance between the antenna and the building, and you know that every time you move the distance 1/2 wavelength between you and the building, the signal coming back as a reflection will go between 0 and 360 degrees of phase angle of reflecting signal. So therefore you can make your measurements in a whole bunch of little distances, slowly moving an inch at a time until you've moved 1/2 wavelength. You've now gone through all the reflections where the reflections coming back are in phase or out of phase with the signal coming out of your antenna. You'll get measurements that have a certain peak to valley ratio to it. And if doing that experiment, you measure a peak impedance of 74 ohms and a valley impedance of 71 ohms, you know that the antenna is very close to 72.5 ohms, if you know what I mean, and therefore the building is giving you very little perturbation to that measurement of the impedance of your antenna. So you can, if you have any doubt as to how deleterious is the nearby objects, there's ways that you can evaluate that. There's ways you can make it better. You can put absorbing material on the face of the building so you can almost stop the reflection from it. But by changing the distance, you can look at the in-phase and the out-of-phase reflection, look at the peak-to-valley, and decide that either it's too big a perturbation or it's spitting in the ocean. Don't worry about it. I wonder if that makes some sense, John. KC2WGB?
Repeater, timeout.
You've got it for comment on that one, John, because that's the question you asked. It's a goodie. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
VDH with a comment.
Waiting for the beep, Dick. Yes, pick up the comment.
Mr. VDH, I should know your name. Please tell me your name and then go ahead with your comment, sir.
Okay, fine business. Thanks, Dick. Good evening to all on the tech. The name is John. Name is John, and the call is WA2VDH. I just wanted to make a comment about the transmission line question before. There's a beautiful video that shows the mechanical equivalent of a transmission line. It's at techchannel.att.com. Once again, that's techchannel.att.com, and enter in the search area similarities in wave behavior by Dr. Scheib. You may have seen this video. I saw it years ago when I was at RCA Institutes. It's this torsion machine which has cross arms, and you see it edge on, and Dr. Scheib shows mechanical torsion waves propagating down and back. It's a beautiful video. It illustrates pulses on the transmission line and as well as sinusoidal sine waves on the transmission line. Once again, that's techchannel.att.com, and the video is Similarities in Wave Behavior by Dr. Scheib. Go ahead.
Very good information, John. I think I've also seen blank the science guy. I think you know who I mean. There's been a number of television programs where periodically they'll show you this. Also, our favorite science teacher at MIT, John, my mind's going blank. What's the name of our favorite science teacher at MIT?
Okay, first one I think you meant was Bill Nye, and the next one would be Levin.
Once again, the science teacher at MIT, which he has all of his great courses, video courses, and he recently got into a little bit of trouble at MIT. You remember Walter Lewin? Yes, Walter Lewin. Walter Lewin has had some experiments like this. Bill Nye, the science guy, I think has had some experiments like this. And so there's some great ways you can make a torsional transmission line. In other words, you're twisting a piece of wire that's got a whole bunch of horizontal bars welded to it, and you can watch that wave moving down the so-called transmission line. That's a lot easier to see it mechanically. I get a slight equivalent of this when I look at the guy wire on my radio tower. I put my head against the guy wire and tap the guy wire and watch a pulse go up the wire, hit the tower, which is a short circuit. The pulse reverses in polarity and comes back down the tower. And also, as you've heard me say so often, let me drop this. Any linear transmission media, whether it be the radio signals travel through air, whether it be pulses of energy traveling down my my guy wire, my tower, whether it be signals traveling down your coaxial cable, the signal going from left to right and the signal going from right to left are thoroughly independent events. They do not mix with each other. It's a hard one to accept. I mean, I can see the mechanical equivalent of that when I tap my guy wire vertically and I watch a pulse go up the tower. And as the pulse hits the tower, reverses in polarity, and coming back down to me, I tap the guy wire again horizontally. I'm now making a horizontal pulse going up my guy wire that encounters the vertical pulse coming back down, and the two pulses phase through each other, pass through each other with no interaction. It's an amazing thing to watch. Most linear transmission media behave that way. So the signal going in one direction and the signal going in the other direction do not mix. And as long as you can evaluate one versus the other, you know what's going to happen. It obeys the law of superposition. It obeys the law of reciprocity. And so linear transmission media do that. You say those words on 20 meters on a Saturday afternoon, and a hell of a lot of people will climb down your throat saying you're absolutely crazy. I change the length of my transmission line. I watch the BizWire change. Those signals are mixing together. Or they'll tell you that when I'm using a slotted line, let me drop it. When I'm using a slotted line, I can find the peak to valley ratio as I slide the carriage on the slotted line. I can see the place where the two voltages, one going to the left to the right and one going right to the left, I can find the place where they're in phase and I get a peak of voltage, and I can find a place where the valley in phase and I get where they're out of phase and I get a valley in voltage, and therefore it looks like the two signals have mixed together on the slotted line. They haven't. You created the mixture. That probe of your slotted line is a non-directional voltage detecting device. It picks up some of the voltage of the signal coming from left to right. It picks up some of the signal coming from right to left. Your probe mixes the two signals together, and you see the standing wave ratio. John, KC2WGV, recently did an experiment where instead of using an ordinary simple probe, he made a directional coupler type of probe, a probe that could sense the signal flowing from left to right, independent of the signal flowing right to left. When he used his directional detecting probe, as he slid the carriage and he's measuring the forward going signal, there was essentially no change. And what little change he had is really measuring the directivity of his probe. If his probe was perfect in directivity, he could slide the carriage and measure the forward going signal and see no change in signal strength versus position. And then he could reverse the probe and look at the reflected signal and again slide the carriage and there'll be no change. So it's only the non-directional probe of a slotted line that allows you to see the two signals in phase and out of phase. Whether or not they really go in phase and out of phase on the transmission line is a subject we can argue for some time, but if you made the leap of faith to say that they don't mix in any way on the transmission line, let me drop it. As long as the transmission line is acting in a linear manner, you haven't made the signal so large that you've arced over the transmission line with a megavolt, with a megawatt pulse of RF energy. As long as you haven't created a nonlinearity by going so strong that you get an arcing, you get a discharge, up to that point, those signals are thoroughly independent. Transmission lines behave that way. And so a number of people have said, hey, you have a certain voltage between center conductor and shield. How in the world can you say that the two signals are not mixing together? There's a certain amount of voltage from each signal. Well, it turns out that you've got, along the transmission line, you have something called the pointing vector. The signal that's flowing from left to right has a certain polarity at each instant of time and a certain direction of current flow. The signal flowing in the other direction has maybe at that instant the exact same voltage at that particular point on the transmission line, but the current is in the opposite direction. The combination of the current and the voltage on the transmission line creates a very directional signal. It's called the pointing vector. One way of looking at it is you could point your thumb in the direction that you think the signal is flowing, and you rotate your fingers that are out straight. You start off at 12 o'clock and rotate them toward 3 o'clock. What you've done is the vector equivalent of what's called E cross H. E is the voltage magnitude at that particular point, at that instant of time. H is the current magnitude, the magnetic field, so to speak. And as you rotate between the voltage and its polarity and the current by rotating your hand, you're now rotating your hand in the form of the advance of a right-handed screw thread that tells you the direction of propagation. The pointing vector tells you the magnitude of the signal and the direction in which it's propagating. Let me drop. So a signal that creates a pointing vector on your transmission line from left to right, and another signal on the same frequency or different frequency, doesn't matter, even if it came from the exact same signal generator, and it's a reflected signal on a transmission line that's got some VSWR at the end of it, you still have a separate signal flowing in the other direction, which has its own pointing vector, its own magnitude and direction of propagation. And as long as the line is made in a uniform manner, that signal will travel only in one direction until it hits some kind of a change in impedance or change in transmission line diameters or whatever. If the transmission line is uniform and linear, the signal flows in one direction only. That's the magic of a transmission line. There's a whole bunch of antennas and transmission lines. They've got a whole lot of magic, as you can tell. Okay, we've had an unusual kind of question and answer period tonight. I'm going to pass it over and ask you guys, the next thing we should go on to our schedule is John's mailbag, just in case somebody happens to have a real burning question that you think you should handle right now. call it is right now if you think you've got a burning question. If not, we're going to go over to John, then we're going to go over to Paul, and then we'll go back to questions if that's what you guys want to do. Anybody with a burning question, give me your call letters and name right now. KQIW on the deck net.
I think I have a question. Put me down for after the mailbag and Paul Spaceport or whatever. And 2EO.
Okay, I heard both Rich and 2EO, and I heard another person who I think was on Echo Link. Who was the other person?
KC2SHO coming in on IRLP.
About a double bazooka antenna being relatively more quiet than other kinds of dipoles, because I haven't been able to find anything about that. And my friend Sherwin, W4QNW, said he had that information about it being a quieter antenna, and I don't know where that comes from. So if you have some time later on, by all means, if you could address it, thank you. Okay, 2JAS, portable door.
Okay, we heard Roger, we heard K2SHO, we heard M2EO. And we'll try to pick you guys up after we go to the mailbag. John, what kind of questions we've got? Are we going to have some more guys stumping us tonight, John? KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet with the mailbag.
WHY, put me on the list for the questions, okay?
We got you, Joe. Go ahead, John.
Okay, just wanted to let it drop. KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Well, we got a couple of simple... we'll go through these quick, I think. This gentleman needs some help. He has three antennas, and the one he's having trouble with is a 20-meter horizontal dipole. Let me let it drop. During normal conditions, average humidity, good temperatures, no problem, the antenna works fine. However, when it rains, SWR goes from like 1.15 to almost 3, and knows it's hurting him in the distance. He has replaced the insulators, which there were 4 of. He replaced the balun, done everything but replace the wire. He'd like to know, what is he overlooking? It's suspended between 2, as the rest of them are, which are giving him no problem at all. What else should he try to track down? Where do you think that's coming from? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB. That's 20 meter. I didn't know if I said that. 20 meter antenna.
When you said replace the wire, are you talking about the wire of the antenna, or are you talking about the transmission line? If you are talking about the transmission line, do you think he's using open wire line or coaxial cable? Over to you for some answers on those, John. Go ahead.
Right, he did not replace the number 14 gauge wire that the elements of the antenna are made out of. He's feeding that with RG8U.
The good news of RG8U is that it has a polyethylene dielectric, the insulating material between semiconductor and the shield, and that material is, for the most part, pretty impervious to water. Not very much water can soak into that. So therefore, water in the middle of the cable, very unlikely. Water getting into the connector at the end of the cable, that's something to worry about. One of the things that we quite often forget about is that air is one hell of a power piston. If the sun is shining on my antenna on a hot summer day, and it's at some nice high temperature, and all of a sudden rain comes along and cools off the antenna real fast, cools off the transmission line real fast, now you've got water on the outside of the transmission line, and whatever air is inside of that connector and adapters and so on, that air is compressing. It is contracting because it went from a high temperature to a low temperature, and it will suck in water. And water inside of a connector can give you a pretty high standing wave ratio and a pretty high loss. Some of the clues will be, he's suspecting that the rain is getting into somewhere and creating the grief. Let me drop. If he had the opportunity to look at the weather report and know that rain is going to happen at 3 in the afternoon, and he's measuring his VISWAR starting at 2:50 in the afternoon, and as it starts raining, he's measuring his VISWAR. And then maybe whether or not the VISWAR at the end of the rain, does the Vizwire go back to normal in 10 minutes, in an hour, in 3 hours? These will give you some clues. You know darn well the droplets of water on a 20-meter dipole antenna, that's an extremely minor perturbation. Droplets of water on a 432 Yagi antenna, if the Yagi antenna is made out of 1/8-inch diameter rods, the water droplets will make a considerably measurable difference in antenna performance, standing wave ratio, directivity gain. Let me drop. And if the rods are, if the elements of the 432 Yagi are made out of 3/16 diameter rods, a little bit thicker, the water has almost no effect. So, in the case of an 80-meter dipole, or 20-meter dipole, water on the dipole itself, I doubt it. Water on the insulators, kind of, the end insulators, I kind of doubt it. Are the end insulators going into a rope that goes to the trees, or wire? That would make some difference. Because water sitting on that insulator, if the rest of the suspending structure to the tree was wire versus a roof, that would make a lot of difference. But in the case of a dipole on 20 meters, the tips are very sensitive to objects there, but the droplets of water going into rope at that insulator, I doubt it. Droplets of water on that insulator going to a wire, that could definitely do it. The center of the dipole is a little bit sensitive. Is water getting into that structure? So, as you can tell, I don't know, but it would be an interesting science experiment to see the time domain plot of standing wave ratio when you know that rain is about to start and stop. How quickly does the rain do its job? How quickly does it dry out and go back to normal? These will give you some clues even before you start making changes to the antenna itself. KC2WGB, K2RIW, with a bunch of guesses. I'm not sure on this one.
KC2WGB. Well, I do have a little more information. What he actually did was he hooked up his MFJ analyzer. That's where he checked that 1.15. He notices after 30 or 40 minutes of a good rain, that's when the problem starts. And he tried, like, shaking the wires and things like that. What I was going to recommend, something similar to what you said, I think he should cut off the end of the coax cable, replace the 2L, PL259, and maybe cut back about 6 inches on the cable in case he had a flashover on it or something like that, which may be an issue. But that's the only data he gave me, that anywhere between, with a good downfall, between a half hour and 45 minutes, that's when he notices the problem. And he says it doesn't clear up until the next day.
Yeah, that's beyond the point of water on an egg insulator at the tip of the dipole. It wouldn't take that long for the water to evaporate and go away. But water inside of a PL259. A PL259 is a beautiful connector in that you can use it up to at least 1296 megacycles. It's called a UHF connector, and it really does work very nicely at UHF frequencies. You can study the diameter of the center conductor and the diameter of the outer conductor inside the connector, and when you do that, you'll conclude that it's something like a 37 ohm impedance, which is not bad. It's only an inch long. An inch long at most of the wavelengths you're talking about. You study that in various ways, and you'll find out it's an extremely minor perturbation. The good news is that it's an inexpensive connector. It can tolerate a lot of high power, and it's relatively easy to install. The bad news is that it really is not weatherproofed. Until you wrap it with the right kind of materials to stop water from getting into that connector, water will climb into it. And even if you, the junction of the connector into the rest of the antenna structure, let me drop it. Even if though you've done a good job of wrapping that with some kind of shrinkable tape, for instance, and stop the water from getting into the back end of the connector, you then have to worry about the water getting into the front end of the connector. There's some kind of a junction between your PL259 at the end of the cable and the SO239 that you screw it into at your center insulator of your dipole, and the way that structure is waterproofed. climb into the center pin of the SO239. So there's lots of ways that water can get in there. And right now, the symptoms we've heard sound like water in that connector at that junction. And how you weatherproof that junction, there's an art and science to that that's not obvious. Sometimes you can loop the transmission line up and back down into the center conductor, center insulator for the dipole, so that water tends to run out of the connector instead of into it. The most convenient way to set the dipole up is for the transmission line to come from the ground straight up into that center insulator. If you can somehow loop the transmission line up and back down, that could save you an awful lot of grief of water getting into that connector. KC2WGB, K2IW in the tech net.
Pull down it, trip, we'll dig, and so we out.
Sounds good. So, it's almost an inverted drip loop, but yes, bring the transmission line. It takes a mechanical structure to do this, but bring the transmission line up and back down where it makes the connection. I think that's worth a try. Over to you, John.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yes, I think that's a good recommendation. And because the balun is hanging below the two center insulators, I think you could do that very easily, just invert the balun. Also, what do you think of this? Supposing he were to put a dummy load up there, put a 50-ohm load up there, and wait for the rain with his meter, see if it still happens with the 50-ohm load up there. That might help. What do you think of that?
That could give you a clue that the water is getting into that last PL-259 connector into the end of the coax cable. However, for all we know, there's other mechanical structures by which the center insulator of the dipole is funneling the water into the connector. The fact that you don't get the effect with the dummy load is a positive but indefinite result. Not easy to interpret the result as to where the real grief is coming from. You're going to have to look at that center insulator on the dipole very carefully with a weather-sensitive eye, EYE, if you know what I mean, to try to figure out all the ways that water can get in there. And maybe this drip loop idea is worth a try. Mechanically, it's going to require a fancy structure with some gravity balancing to make that happen, but I think it's worth a try. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Very good, Dick. Well, we'll take the recommendations, and let's see if he writes me back and emails me a fix. That'd be nice to know. All right, let it drop and go on to the next one. Okay, have a young amateur here that's working 2 meters at a 440. And he's using this dual antenna, and that antenna is rated for 100 watts. Question is, when he's using two transmitters that exceed 100 watts, one was for the 70 centimeter and one for 30, does he have anything to worry about because he's over 200 watts at that time? What do you think of that, Dick?
So if I understand correctly, it's a dual band antenna made for those two frequencies, possibly one piece of coax cable going into the antenna, down in the shack. I presume there are two separate transmitters going into a diplexer assembly. In other words, there's a filter-like assembly that allows the 440 transmitter to apply its signal to the coax cable, and none of it goes into the 2-meter transmitter, and vice versa. So is that what we're saying, John?
Yes, that's correct, Dick.
There may or may not be a problem. If the antenna was truly rated at 100 watts maximum, steady state, no safety factor built into that, and if both of those transmitters are running key down for some amount of time, that antenna has a certain amount of thermal mass to it, therefore it's got a thermal time constant. If you applied 100 watts, the maximum power it's able to tolerate, and if the maximum temperature it could tolerate was, let me pick a number, 80 degrees centigrade, and you watched with a thermal imaging camera that antenna as you applied the 100 watts, you may discover that, yes, it comes up to 80 degrees centigrade, but it takes 2 minutes to do it. Maybe that's the thermal time constant of the antenna, in which case the antenna can take it for steady state, 100 watts, but if each of the individual transmissions are seconds each. Now we're talking about duty factor, if you know what it means. So even if the manufacturer was telling the absolute truth, 100 watts, and you put 200 watts in there, but it's very temporary. In other words, the probability of both transmitters being on simultaneously only happens 10% of the time, and the longest duration it happens for is 20 or 30 seconds. You might very well get away with it. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
I believe you're right, Dick. Duty cycle is the key there, and if both of them were keyed down for a length of time, it may cause an issue. Other than that, with communication and they'd be out of sync, he might be able to get away with that, so I don't think he has too much to worry about. Okay, let's go over to Paul, or if you want to pick up those other questions, we'll do that too, because it's going to close in on Paul a little bit. So back to you, Dick. KC2WGB from the mailbag.
Yeah, I think we should go over to Paul because an awful lot has happened this week in space. Awful lot has happened on the ground from space. I think some astronauts have come back down. Some other guys are going back up. Some cargo is back going back up. Other satellites are being launched that are trying to measure gravity waves. There's a lot happening out there. Bring us up to speed, Paul. And once again, I am guessing it's roughly 133 astronomical units between us and the Voyager spacecraft out there beyond Pluto at around 12 billion miles, approximately three times the distance to Pluto. That spacecraft is way out there. I dream about that before. WS2N, our space expert, with report number 179, I think, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, it is 179, and this is WS2N. Good evening, John, Dick, everybody. I think it's 134 from Earth now and 133 still from the Sun. You know, the borderline has just been crossed for another AU on Voyager 1. So Voyager 2 is behind that. Yeah, Dick, well, people have come back from space and people are going to be going up. We have a crew, Expedition 45, that just returned. One American, one guy from Japan, and the Russian commander, successfully undocked from the space station in a Soyuz spacecraft, and came back down. And it's amazing how fast they do it, you know. After getting into Soyuz, they take about an hour, maybe an hour and a half before they get a good distance away from the spacecraft, from the space station, and then they fly their rockets to slow down. And they say it's 125 meters per second that they slow down. But in that short blast, for about 4 minutes, that slows them down to get back to Kazakhstan. Probably about an hour and a half. An hour and 45 minutes tops. They landed at night, and snowing out, very cold. Normally they have a tent ready for them, and they put them in a tent and do a medical check when they pull them out of the spacecraft. But in this case, they didn't plan on that. They just used four helicopters instead of usually about eight, and they picked them, once they got them out, quick check, and then into the helicopters, and they were gone because of the cold weather and very windy. In fact, the parachutes pulled the spacecraft over on its side after it landed. It comes down, the Soyuz rocket has, spacecraft has rockets right at the last second they go off to slow the impact down. And then right after that, the Soyuz tips over, and that's where they were sitting at night. So I got a chance to follow this on the NASA programming, off the computer. Very interesting. But now, that backed at least three people on board the space station, but not for long. On the 15th of this month, they'll send three more up to the space station. Another launch from Kazakhstan. That'll bring the crew back up to six. Things are going good with the American launches in the next couple of years. There'll be a permanent crew of seven. That's the goal, not six. They're hoping to do that. That would double the output time of science on board the space station. They're doing good up there. The space station now is still planned to last till 2024. A couple of other countries now have signed on for that duration, except for the European Space Agency. Right now they're signed up until 2020, but they expect to join the group very shortly. Japan already signed up for it. Russia signed up for it. And after that, possibly 2028, but maybe not. And right now, NASA themselves are looking to get out of the space station business. So, I don't know, they might call it quits after 2024 now. We'll have to see what happens after that. Who knows? The private industry might get involved. Right now, nobody's interested. It's a lot of money to keep that place up. It's like keeping a 40-story building in operation at 17,000 miles an hour. Let me drop it. For now, the Cygnus spacecraft, we talked about that last week, successfully docked with the International Space Station and sent over 7,000 pounds of supplies, science equipment, water to the space station. And that all happened when there were six people on board. Gerald Lindbergh, the American astronaut in charge of the robotic arm, when Cygnus got close by, grappled it, and he attached it to the Unity node on the Earth-facing port. So the first time that they've been able to utilize that port since they disconnected the Leonardo pressure module from that port back in March and relocated it to another node. So, that's up and running. They'll be unloading that for the next couple of, probably next 6 weeks to 2 months. They'll unload it and load it up with trash. And in that time, probably SpaceX will probably come up with the Dragon. That'll be a cargo flight, and they'll have more stuff in delivered to the space station. And then they'll dock to the other port, the one that they've been using all along. The Unity port is new, and they'll be docking Dragon back to the original Harmony port, again, the Earth-facing port. The two spacecraft will be sitting side by side for about a week or so until they undock Cygnus and send that to a fiery death. Not so for SpaceX with its Dragon. That will bring back scientific equipment and mechanical stuff from the space station, and they'll land that in the Pacific Ocean, and that's a different type of deal. So we'll see what happens. There's a small company out is doing test flights for NASA. Signed up with them for one particular test that they wanted to do. And the name of the company is called Up Aerospace, and they've been launching out of Spaceport America. It's located in New Mexico for a couple of years. Every now and then they'll have a flight. They do suborbital flights, and they have paying customers, and NASA is one. And one of the things that NASA wanted to test was this re-entry type of vehicle, very small, but very strong, and very resilient. Got parachutes and everything on it. And the reason they're testing this, in the future, they want to have these things brought up to the space station, and they'll be able to drop it out of the space station and have it deorbit and send supplies back to the back to Earth. So this private company up aerospace successfully did that, and it's just interesting because I find that there's a big space race going on with all these companies. This one will probably step up the game over the next couple of years, maybe eventually have an orbital spacecraft that they'll be working on. Another company is Firefly. They have another, that's the name of another company that's going to be doing suborbital flights as well.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Kilograms of material into space on their space flights, to orbital flights. But, just to keep an eye on these companies. The last one I mentioned, Firefly, only came out within the last year in January of 2014. This WS2M. And like you said, a lot of things going on, not only with our country, but internationally. Japan is very happy. They had a spacecraft that 5 years ago they wanted to orbit it around Venus, to do investigation of that planet. But it missed its mark. Had a valve stick open on one of the braking motors, and it just flew right past Venus 5 years ago. It wound up going in orbit around the sun. But now it's made another close pass toward Venus the other day, and they figured out by using thrusters, their thruster rockets, and fuel on that. If everything would go right, they could go into a highly elliptical orbit, but an orbit is, any kind of an orbit they would have considered successful. And it was successful. They did that, and now we have another orbiting spacecraft around Venus. We haven't had one by the United States in quite a while. The last one that we had was Magellan. European Space Agency had one not too long ago, but the end of that scientific mission was over. So there was nothing until now. So we'll look forward to Japan having a successful science mission at Venus. So that's pretty much it for that. I mean, there's many things going on, like you said before, Dick, but I'll drop it and let you have it. Another month from now, we should have, less than a month, SpaceX going up with their new advanced, newly improved Falcon 9 rocket. So, they've been out of business since June, since their rocket exploded, but they'll be back this month, and probably at least a couple of flights per month over the next year. Back to the K2RIW WS2.
The next SpaceX Falcon 9 going up this month, is that a cargo mission or is that a human mission? I'm going to guess it's cargo. Is that true, Paul? And roughly how many pounds of cargo?
It's neither. National human missions will be coming up in the end of 2016, or probably, more likely, of course, the beginning of 2017. And they're getting ready for that, as well as Boeing with their Starliner spacecraft. But no, this one's a satellite launch mission. Company puts satellites up on a regular basis, and this one happens to be 11 different satellites all in one. So I think they're going into roughly a 400 mile orbit. So two things interesting with this: it's called a full thrust mission. Full thrust, the first of the full thrust Falcon 9. 33% more capability.